You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Artificial intelligence has not reached the level of human intelligence, and according to today's guest, it's not going to do so anytime soon. But in societies with increasingly complex institutions, computer technology can help us to become smarter at every level, from communities to markets to democracies. We'll be talking about all that today with Professor Tom Malone. Stay with us. Support for the Radio Cafe comes from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a reading and conversation by Deborah Levy with Jonathan Freeman on Wednesday, October 30th at 7 o'clock at the Lensic. Deborah Levy is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and writes fiction, plays, and poetry. The author of beloved books including Hot Milk and Swimming Home, both Man Booker Prize finalists, and Things I Don't Want to Know, her latest novel is The Man Who Saw Everything, longlisted for the 2019 Booker Prize. Tickets available at the Lensic, 988-1234, or lensic.org. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Elevating interest and opportunities in STEM, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the Lannan Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. I'd like to welcome Tom Malone. He's professor of management at the MIT Sloan School of Management, and he's founding director of the MIT Center for Collective Intelligence. He's the author of several books, including The Future of Work and Superminds, and he will be in Santa Fe on Wednesday, October 16th at 6:30 at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. The talk is titled Superminds, The Surprising Power of People and Computers Thinking Together. Welcome, Tom Malone, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Great pleasure to be here.
So first of all, tell us what you mean by the term supermind.
So I define a supermind as a group of individuals acting together in ways that seem intelligent. That sounds like a fairly simple definition, but it turns out every word in that definition just about is important. You have to have a group. You have to have individuals who can be people or computers, or for that matter, even bees or ants or neurons. They need to be acting in some way to be a supermind, as I define it. In other words, it can't just be something written with knowledge like a Wikipedia or a book, but you have to have some entity that can behave, can act. And the different entities in the group have to behave in a way that's connected. And most importantly, they have to be able to behave in a way that seems intelligent.
Well, this is the thing that was so interesting to me in that first chapter of your book, where you talked about studying groups of people in order to identify the components of group intelligence in the same way that you might identify an individual's intelligence by administering some kind of IQ test or some other kind of test. Group intelligence is studyable. It is, to some extent, definable. And there are some characteristics that intelligent groups have in common. What are those characteristics? We're not even talking about computers here. We're talking about groups of people.
Exactly. So what we did in that study that you're talking about was to essentially create something like an IQ test for groups. In other words, we used the same statistical techniques that are used in individual intelligence tests, like IQ tests, but we applied those techniques to groups. And what we found was that there's a single statistical factor for a group, just as there is for an individual, that predicts how well the group will perform on a wide range of very different kinds of tasks. That's what we call general intelligence in an individual. And what we found was that groups have a kind of general intelligence also. What we also found was what predicts how intelligent, how collectively intelligent a group will be. We first thought that the main predictor would just be how smart the individual members of the group are. But we found that's correlated, but only moderately correlated with the collective intelligence of the group. In other words, if you have a bunch of smart people in a group, that doesn't necessarily make a smart group. So most of us know that one way or another from our own experience, but here's a very scientific demonstration of that. So that leads to an obvious question. If having smart people in the group isn't enough to make a smart group, then what is? And we found three other factors in our work that were significantly correlated with the group's collective intelligence. The first was the social perceptiveness, or you might call it the social intelligence of the group members. We measured this by showing people pictures of other people's eyes and asking them to guess what emotion the person in the picture was feeling. It turns out when you've got a bunch of people in a group who are good at doing that, then on average, the group is more collectively intelligent than when you don't.
Which is fascinating, because when you think about the kinds of things that groups are engaged in, they're not necessarily engaged in reading each other's eyes. They're engaged in solving problems like climate change or whatever, you know, a neighborhood issue or whatever's at hand.
Exactly. So what I think, and this is actually based on another study we did, we compared face-to-face groups and online groups. So in the online groups, people could only communicate with each other by typing text messages to each other. They couldn't even see each other's faces much, or their eyes or anything. But we found almost exactly the same correlation there. In other words, when you have people who are good at reading emotions in eyes, they can work together better online by typing to each other, not just face-to-face when they're looking at each other. So what I think that means is that this test that's directly measuring how well you can read emotions in other people's eyes must also be correlated with a much broader range of interpersonal skills. So I think that that's why this test, I think, can be usefully called a measure of not just social perceptiveness, which is what it's directly measuring, but also social intelligence. I think it's a way of measuring how well people can work with other people. And in a certain sense, shouldn't be surprising that that predicts how intelligent a group will be.
And the other predictors were people giving each other space to speak in the conversation and nobody dominating too much. And then the third one was having
lots of women
in the group.
Oh, you spoiled my punchline there.
Right. I'm sorry.
Right. So the second one, as you were saying, was how evenly people participated in the conversation. So we found that when one or two people dominated the group's conversation, on average, the group was less collectively intelligent than when they participated more equally. And then, as you already let the cat out of the bag, the finding that most people found most interesting was that we found that the collective intelligence of a group was correlated with the proportion of women in the group. More women was correlated with more intelligent groups.
And it didn't stop at 50%.
It didn't stop at 50%. We're still not sure exactly kind of what the total trend is, but it looks like it continues to increase up to close to all women. One interesting feature, though, is that that result was mostly explained by the result about social intelligence.
Right.
In other words, it was known before our work that women on average scored higher on this test of social intelligence than men. And so one possible interpretation of our results is that what you need for a group to be collectively intelligent is that you have enough people in the group who are high on this measure of social intelligence. And if you have that, then it may not matter much whether those people are men or women. It's just that if you don't know anything about a person except their gender, you're a little more likely to get that with a woman than with a man.
So in human societies, what are the different kinds of superminds that you've found? What are the most ancient ones? What are the most recent? And is there a kind of progression?
Well, one of the important things I did in the book, I think, was to identify five different types of superminds, focused specifically on how those superminds make decisions. I think I'm going to give them to you in a way that's not exactly historical order. I'm going to start with the one that's most common and most easily recognized, that is hierarchies. Hierarchies are very important in our world today. In hierarchies, groups make decisions by delegating them to specific people in the group, and people are supposed to follow orders from their superiors in the hierarchy. In a certain sense, I suppose perhaps this is the first kind of group to appear because most families are, at least in some sense, hierarchies, at least when the kids, especially when the kids are very young. But what we've found in recent centuries is that this is a very good way of organizing large organizations as well. A second way of organizing human groups, a second type of supermind, is democracies. In democracies, the group decisions are made by voting, whether that happens in a government or in a club or some other group. And that's a more recent, in fact, a much more recent invention in human society. There may have been some kind of informal democracy earlier, but kind of formal voting is a pretty recent kind of supermind. Another very important kind of supermind is markets, where all the goods and services we depend on markets for are provided by these market superminds. The way the market makes group decisions is essentially by the combination of all the pairwise agreements between individual buyers and sellers. Markets also are a somewhat more recent invention, though there may have been very informal forms of them long ago. The kinds of global markets that we have today are a modern invention, which in many ways is responsible for much of the prosperity we have. And now I'm kind of working backwards to the probably one of the oldest forms of supermind, which is communities. Humans for many millennia lived in hunting and gathering societies whose primary organizational unit was tribes or a certain kind of small community. And in a community, group decisions are made by a kind of informal consensus based on norms and reputations. We have lots of communities still today, from local neighborhoods to families to small work groups to things like the global scientific communities in different disciplines. So those are four very important kinds of superminds, and they all involve at least some amount of cooperation among the group members. There's a fifth kind of supermind, which is what happens when you don't have any cooperation among the members of the groups. That's what I call ecosystems. And in some sense, this is the most ancient type of supermind of all. In an ecosystem, the decisions are made by the law of the jungle. Whoever has the most power gets what they want, and by the survival of the fittest. So that's kind of the spectrum of five important kinds of superminds we see all around us all the time.
And I think, I mean, the word ecosystem is used these days by so many different people to mean not ecosystem, not an actual ecosystem, but a kind of like human analog of an ecosystem. And I think it's important to kind of acknowledge that other life forms, whether it be primates or bees or fish or plants, constitute superminds. None of them operates as an individual. The whole idea of individuality is something that's a fairly recent human kind of construct in a way, and that these operate on, as you said, the law of the jungle and power, but also very much on cooperation and very complex rules and sets of practices that creatures use and that we have very much within us as creatures who evolved on this planet.
Absolutely. In fact, many kinds of animals, as you mentioned, bees, ants, etc., have a kind of collective intelligence in their beehives or ant colonies. That's in some cases remarkably intelligent, remarkably powerful. I think I would analyze much of that as a kind of community. The ants in an ant colony, for instance, have a set of norms, or in this case, they're actually often kind of instinctive, genetically determined rules about what they do in certain situations, how they respond to certain kinds of chemical smells from other ants, and how they respond when ants move their bodies in certain ways and so forth. So you could think of those as norms hardwired into the individual ants, but they interact in ways that make the ant colony as a whole operate very intelligently. They can often essentially send out scouts to find out where the food is. And by the way, the scouts come act when they come back. Other ants know which ways are likely to have food and which ways aren't, and so forth. So I think that's a very important kind of collective intelligence in the animal world long before humans.
So the whole idea here is that we humans act collectively. That's part of what we do and what we've always done, and that we as communities, as markets, as hierarchies, as democracies, and so on, are all acting in a way that we are greater than any individual and greater than the sum of our parts. And what this book is very much about is how computers, when we work with them in a thoughtful way, can actually be part of this supermind. And one thing I thought was so interesting was you were talking about artificial intelligence, and there's all this stuff where people are continually talking about the singularity and about AI being able to generate intelligence which is greater than our own. And I thought was kind of funny was for years and years and years, decades, everybody's saying, oh, that's 25 years off. 30 years ago, they were saying, 50 years ago, they were saying it was 25 years off. They'll probably be saying that 30 years from now. But it's probably going to be longer than that if it happens at all. Just quickly, why is that? Like, why do we not have AI that's as smart as humans now, do you think?
Well, it's a very good point. And as you're right, I said in the book that people have been trying to predict when we'll have human-level AI ever since the beginning of the field of AI in the 1950s. And for that entire time, people have predicted that AI was about 20 or 25 years in the future. So for 60 years, it's been 20 years away. It's theoretically possible that this time it'll be right, that prediction will be right, but I think it's quite unlikely, and I think we should be skeptical of anyone who confidently claims that we'll have that. One reason why it's easy for us to mistakenly predict how soon this will happen is that it's very easy for us to imagine machines as smart as people. One reason I think it's so easy for us to imagine that is that our science fiction is full of it.
Right.
Science fiction books, science fiction movies, they're full of robots that are about as smart as people, maybe a little smarter, but they kind of look like people, they act like people, they more or less think like people. Very easy to imagine that, but it turns out it's very difficult technically to create such things. AI researchers have made huge progress in the last 60 years or so, but I and many of the people I know who are very expert in this area believe that even though we've made remarkable progress, there's still a lot of really hard things about how intelligence works that we don't understand yet. I can't remember who said this, but somebody was quoted as saying something like we're at least 5 Nobel Prizes away from having human-level artificial intelligence. In other words,
right.
It's not just that we need to do a little more work of the kind we've already done. It's like we need some major conceptual insights, and not just one of them, but a bunch of them. To really figure out how to have human-level AI.
But what we do have is we have very specialized AI. I mean, you make the point that general intelligence is what humans have. We can do all kinds of things very quickly in succession or even at the same time, whereas computers are very good at doing one thing in a specialized way. How can those types of artificial intelligence or information technology improve the institutions that you were talking about? Like, for example, the practice of democracy. I mean, high tech has not always been good for democracy, as we've seen with the debacle of computerized voting machines and Cambridge Analytica and some of those real issues that have led to the opposite of democracy.
Right. You could add fake news to that list as something that makes
right.
democracies more stupid in a way. Yes, I think there are a bunch of examples in my book about how computers can help make these different kinds of superminds more intelligent. One that you were alluding to in your question is about democracies. One of the intriguing things I think for us to consider is what's called liquid democracy. Most of us know about direct democracy, like was practiced in ancient Greece, where everybody gets to vote directly on the issues. We all know in our modern democratic governments about representative democracy, where people get to vote to elect representatives who then vote on their behalf on the issues that need to be decided by the government. What liquid democracy is a kind of combination of those two possibilities, where you at least have the potential to get the best of both worlds. Shall I explain to you how that works?
Sure.
So in a liquid democracy, as a voter, you can, if you want, always vote directly on any issue. But most of us don't begin to have enough time or interest in voting on all the things that a government needs to decide. So in a liquid democracy, you can also delegate your right to vote to anyone else you want to. It doesn't have to be one person elected as the representative for thousands of others. You can give your right to vote to somebody, and I can give mine to somebody else. And in fact, we can do that separately for different issues.
Meaning your best super nerdy politico kind of friend kind of thing?
Exactly. Or you might give some of your right to vote on military issues to one friend who's really into thinking about conflict and military and those kinds of things. And you might give your right to vote about environmental issues to another friend who has the same views you do about what we should do about the environment. And each of them could in turn delegate your proxy for voting, your voting rights, further to other people who knew about even more specialized things that needed to be voted on. So you can do all that multiple levels of delegating, and then if the people who have your voting proxies aren't voting the ways you want them to, you can always take back your proxy, vote directly yourself, or give your proxy to somebody else.
I'd love to see a simulation of that.
Yeah, well, there have actually been more than simulations. There have been some countries around the world that have experimented with this and had a fair amount of success already. There are several European countries where they've elected representatives who campaigned on the platform that if I am elected, I will vote for the things that the people in this online voting platform tell me to vote for. And there have been people elected on that basis in several places around the world, including in Iceland. That was the leading party for some time. And there have even been people who've run on that platform, though I don't think any have been elected, in various states in the U.S. So I think the potential there is that it's, first of all, a kind of democracy that's not even really feasible without information technology and computers. And it's one that at least has the potential to be much more responsive to what the voters actually want, and to also be able to take advantage of specialized knowledge in a much more effective way than most democracies do today.
Well, one thing I thought was so interesting was, I mean, there's, I guess, a kind of a truism that people are better off when they're working face-to-face and they can see each other and listen to each other's voices and so on. But there are things that we actually do better without seeing each other, not necessarily in real time. And you gave the example of the near impossibility of efficient consensus-based decision-making in person from something that you witnessed at Occupy Wall Street. And I think many people who've been involved in kind of leftist politics and are trying to do consensus have walked away very frustrated. You contrast that to another consensus, absolutely consensus-based institution like Wikipedia. It's like night and day.
Yes. Yeah. As you say, I sat in on some of the Occupy Wall Street conversations when I was on sabbatical in New York, as that was taking place. And it was so frustrating. I was there for about 2 or 3 hours, and I was listening to a group that was trying to come up with a mission statement for Occupy Wall Street. And when I arrived, they had started by saying, "We believe in a free and just society." And someone had just proposed, "Well, I think it should be, we believe in a truly free and just society." So for the next 2 hours, they debated whether the word "truly" should be added. And most frustrating.
You're tearing your hair out.
Exactly. And I think one of the most frustrating things about it was very little of that discussion was even about the merits of the word "truly." Most of it was really bureaucratic discussion about what are the rules we should use to decide whether we can adopt this word or not. And they had something like someone had blocked it in a way that prevents the group from agreeing to it, but then the person withdrew her block, and they had a long discussion about whether we can go ahead now or whether we can't or whatever. So very frustrating. And as you say, the contrast to Wikipedia was quite remarkable, because Wikipedia makes all kinds of decisions about what changes to make in the Wikipedia articles by a kind of informal online consensus, which is that if anybody thinks it should be changed, they can change it. And it keeps changing until nobody thinks anything needs to change for now. So my impression was Occupy Wall Street was never going to accomplish what they were trying to do. And as far as I can tell, they never did. But I suspect that if they had used something like the Wikipedia software, they might have been able to make much more progress.
Very, very interesting. And I don't want to go into it now. People will have to read the book. But you give a very intriguing kind of speculation of what a kind of supermind-based socialism might look like, in which the values that people espouse and that are really very deeply human values, you know, to each according to his need, from each according to his ability, could be put into practice. But I don't want to ask you that right now because people will have to read the book, but it's very interesting. I hope you talk about it at your talk. One of the examples that I wanted to bring up was the possibility of improving our intelligence agencies. And one thing that we know was there was plenty of suspicious information about the people who were taking, for example, large aircraft flying lessons before 9/11, but they didn't really care about learning how to land and things like that. I mean, crazy stuff. Nobody put the information together, even though it was there. What can superminds do about this kind of problem? And also, what's in the way of those kinds of solutions?
Right. Well, superminds are what we've always had to deal with these kinds of problems. So the U.S. intelligence community is already a supermind. But
right.
As you just observed, it wasn't as intelligent as we might have hoped in predicting and avoiding the terrorist attacks of September 11th. But in the book, I have a fairly extended example about how computers might help make a more intelligent supermind for detecting and predicting terrorist activities like that. So, for instance, the computers could help keep track of different probabilities for different events along the, you could call it the supply chain to a terrorist event. So different people could be assessing the probabilities for different things based on what they knew individually and also based on the probabilities that they could see for other events. Like, you know, if you have somebody who enters the U.S. with this kind of passport and this kind of visa history, what's the probability that they're affiliated with a terrorist organization? If somebody takes a flying lesson for large airplanes but without any apparent reason for using that learning, what's the probability that they're thinking of using this as a part of a terrorist attack? So you could have all these kinds of things, different people working on different, assessing the probabilities of different things. And then part of what's cool about doing this in an online system is that all that could be easily communicated to the people who needed to know it. Apparently, part of what went wrong in the actual U.S. intelligence community before 9/11 was that they didn't even communicate with each other. You know, they were at that point using, I think, faxes, and maybe there was some email use, but they had a lot of institutional barriers even for sharing information within the intelligence community. So the FBI wasn't supposed to share certain kinds of things with the CIA unless such and such a condition was met and so forth. Now, some of that may be reasonable, some of it perhaps wasn't. Just because you have computers doesn't mean you get around that automatically. But I think it's certainly possible to imagine ways that computers could help much more efficiently share information among far more people and do some, at least, maybe a non-trivial part of the inferencing, the reasoning that's needed about that information. So sometimes a computer could put two and two together and say, well, it's likely that this other thing is going to happen, without having to have a human do that, and all of it could happen much more effectively, potentially.
And that's the kind of thing you're already seeing in business and in markets that are helped by this exact kind of computer-assisted activity to become more efficient and more successful. But there are things that markets also do that have unintended consequences. And I just came across one the other day, which was absolutely horrifying to me. They call it the economics of extinction. And what that means is that there are people who are overfishing endangered species like bluefin tuna, really to the brink of extinction, even though they have years and years and years of supply frozen in freezers in order to keep prices high. Is there anything that this kind of supermind can do about those really fundamental flaws in markets? Or is that, how do you think about that kind of thing? I mean, those really deep unintended consequences of markets.
Well, it's a very good question. And the way I think of this is in terms of an ecosystem of superminds. So the markets that exist all around us today don't exist in a vacuum. There are other superminds around us also, like government superminds, which you could say are hierarchical enforcement agencies ruled by democratic election of decision makers. So in the case you're describing, if you believe that the market is doing things that aren't good for the society, for the community as a whole, then the supermind of the community can change its opinions in such a way that enough people believe that that thing that's happening is bad, that they vote for representatives who are ready to vote for legislation that makes it impossible to do that bad thing, or at least makes it illegal to do that bad thing. And then the enforcement apparatus of a government hierarchy, whether that's Federal Trade Commission or whatever, those government agencies can then enforce the new rules on the people and the companies who are operating in the markets. So it's not that we don't have a supermind and we need one. It's that we've already got superminds. And what we often want to do in order to, or need to do in order to accomplish what we think should happen, is to influence the superminds that already exist, or in some cases, to create new superminds to do things that aren't being done very well at all. That's a long answer, but I think it's kind of how I think of this, as all the superminds are kind of interacting with each other, like different beasts in the jungle. You know, you've got the community supermind that's kind of trying to control the democracy supermind, which is trying to control the governmental hierarchy supermind, which is trying to control the market supermind. And sometimes one wins, sometimes another wins. It's this constant jockeying for power in the ecosystem of all these different superminds.
Well, I guess, and that brings up a really important question, which is that you've got all of these types of institutions and groups, whether they be everything from a neighborhood to a government to the United Nations to Procter & Gamble, all kinds of companies, and they're all trying to succeed, and some of them are using these computer-assisted superminds. And, you know, then you sort of step back and you say, okay, we're facing ecosystem and environmental destruction due partly to global climate change and also many other factors. We're facing social and economic inequality that are very, very dire. Does the use of these tools favor those who are best at using them and therefore exacerbate inequality? Or could it exacerbate inequality and also really leave out the natural world, which doesn't have access to computers at all?
Well, superminds can do all kinds of things, some of which we really like and some of which are pretty terrible. Some superminds can be evil. So there's no guarantee that a supermind does things we like or even necessarily that it's all that smart. But it's also possible, and in a way, if you choose to look at it positively, it's remarkable how well the superminds we have work, even though they're not perfect by any means. They often do a surprisingly good job of things. For the examples you just mentioned, like dealing with global climate change and dealing with inequality, many people would say that we could and should do a better job of dealing with those things than we're doing so far. In the case of climate change in particular, for instance, one of the other things I talk about in the book is the work we've been doing for over a decade now to create a kind of online supermind to help deal with global climate change. In this case, it's something we call Climate CoLab, and it's a global community of over 100,000 people all over the world, literally, who are coming up with and evaluating ideas for what to do about different aspects of the climate change problem. So I think there are fascinating opportunities for individuals to help create, to participate in, and to influence the superminds that already exist or superminds that can come into being to help influence our world in ways that they think are desirable.
Tom Malone, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Tom Malone is a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, and he's founding director of the MIT Center for Collective Intelligence. He will be in Santa Fe on Wednesday, October 16th at 6:30 at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. For more information, sarweb.org. And a big thank you to our sponsors, the Lenzic Performing Arts Center, the Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation, Southwest Care Center, the Lannan Foundation, and the Santa Fe Institute. You make the Radio Cafe possible. Thanks. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.